Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon. On behalf of the Wyoming Supreme Court's Children's Justice Project, I would like to welcome you to the CJP monthly training series. The training is offered the second Thursday of every month from 12 p.m. to 1 p.m. for key stakeholders involved in the Wyoming juvenile court system. We have a great training lined up for you today. To download the materials for today's training, please visit the CJP website at www.courts.state.wy.us/CJP and click on the training tab. If you have questions, please call in during the last 10 minutes of the training. The phone number is 917-889-8064. Again, that number is 917-889-8064. You may also post questions and comments using the chat session on the Blog Talk Radio website. After today's training, please go to the CJP webpage to complete a survey. We hope you find today's training beneficial.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Blog Talk. My name is Whitney Agopian. I'm the Children's Justice Project Coordinator. We have a fantastic blog talk lined up for you today entitled Discovery in Juvenile Court Proceedings, presented by Wendy Ross, Senior Assistant Attorney General with the Wyoming Attorney General's Office, and Hope Mead, Attorney with the Guardian Ad Litem Division. Hope and Wendy will be providing information on discovery in juvenile court proceedings, including termination of parental rights and Department of Family Services records in other contexts. With that, I'll turn it over to Hope. Thank you.
Thank you, Whitney. Today I'm going to talk about the discovery underlying juvenile proceedings. And that is, I will direct you to Rule 3 and 4 of the Wyoming Juvenile Rules of Procedure, which are the main guidelines in juvenile discovery. This rule places requirements on all parties in juvenile cases. A great deal of information may be shared during the pretrial stage of a case and may help reduce conflict and save court time and resources. Therefore, all attorneys should be actively involved in this stage of the case. I will stress throughout this presentation that in juvenile proceedings, discovery is always ongoing. That being said, the largest requirements are put on the state, who must, in 30 days of service of a petition, provide discovery to the GAL and the respondent. The state must include any exculpatory evidence, a list of and statements of all witnesses, statements written or oral made by the respondent, and all reports of experts that may testify. This includes but is not limited to lab results for EUAs, police reports, mental health evaluations, and the like. This requirement also flows under Rule 4 of the Wyoming Rules of Juvenile Procedure, which states, no later than 5 business days prior to the hearing where any report is offered for consideration, the party offering the report shall file the report with the court and provide a copy of the report to be offered to all other parties. The state must produce anything that is in the possession or control of members of the prosecutor's staff and any other persons who have participated in the investigation or evaluation of the case. This means all officers and DFS staff that have created records, the prosecutor is responsible for providing the documentation of. For you prosecutors, this means you should be requesting notes and documents when needed from the caseworkers. Further representation for the state along with counsel for the agency should counsel the caseworker to make sure that he or she obtains records that are needed or may be needed for later hearings. For example, The case profile should include full mental health and substance abuse treatment records, history for the children and parents, abuse and neglect report with supporting materials about the investigation, past and present, education records, health records, birth certificates for children, death certificates, if any, affidavits of efforts to locate parents, and results of paternity tests. If there is difficulty obtaining these records, the state or attorney for the agency may request a court order to assist in retrieval of these records. As a side note, it is not only the state that should be striving to retrieve these types of records. Guardian ad litem should also be requesting a standard order from the court authorizing the GAL access to all privileged information regarding the child without the necessity for further release. In most instances, the order appointing the GAL will allow the GAL access to this information. However, to get full cooperation and ability to best represent the client, a standard order at the beginning of each case will allow the access quickly and without argument or pushback in most circumstances. This information is not only pertinent to discovery on the onset of the case, but will help with case planning and resource development and the like. You may at this point be wondering to yourself how to deal with legislation that prohibits access to records in juvenile cases, and how we properly access medical and education information. You may also not be wondering this, but I guess I'll tell you anyway. The first and most effective way to obtain a release from the parents and acquire the document in that way. But when that fails, it is important to understand what falls underneath each of these acts and how to navigate these acts to still obtain the information necessary to adjudicate a case and or properly work a case. First, let's briefly explore HIPAA. I will caveat this discussion with the fact that there could be a complete CLE on HIPAA and litigation, but I am just going to briefly explain the basics of the act and how to navigate it for the purposes of juvenile cases. This topic is very important in many of our juvenile cases. Mental health documents of the children and parents in our cases can assist the team in providing proper resources to aid the family in having happy, healthy relationships in a healthy environment for the children. It is also important to understand the medical needs of a child in our cases to make sure that these children are adequately cared for. It also may lead to proper education for parents with children with special mental health needs or physical health needs. HIPAA protected records are also known as protected health information. This is defined as any information, whether oral or recorded, in any form or medium that is created or received by a healthcare provider, health plan, or healthcare clearinghouse, and relates to the past, present, or future physical and mental condition of an individual. It also may be information that relates to the payment, past, present, or future of the healthcare of any individual. Again, the most effective way to get the information is to get a release of information from the parent and or child respondent to obtain HIPAA-protected records. However, it is important that these releases are correct the first time. A HIPAA authorization must describe the information to be disclosed, dictate who is authorized to disclose, dictate who is authorized to receive, describe the purpose of the disclosure, indicate the expiration date or event that will lead to expiration of the release, and it must be signed and dated by the client. It must also include a statement recognizing the patient or parent guardian has the right to revoke the consent at any time. With this type of release, the GAL, state's attorney, or members of DFS should be able to access all medical records necessary in a case. It is also possible to get an order for the respondent to sign such a release. As the court has jurisdiction over all members of the family in juvenile proceedings, it is appropriate to ask for an order requiring such a release be signed. If you do not wish to pursue an order for a release, HIPAA does permit disclosure for judicial or administrative proceedings without consent of the parent or child through a court order or order of an administrative tribunal or through a subpoena, discovery request, or other lawful process. One of the most effective ways out of these options is a subpoena of records from the provider. However, it is likely at this time, the time that you provide the subpoena, the provider will attempt to quash the subpoena if they cannot get authorization from the parent. A hearing will be held, and then the court will then make a ruling on the necessity of the record, and if appropriate, provide you with the necessary court order to obtain the document. At this time, it might also be discussed about a protective order to further provide confidentiality for these documents. Protective orders will be talked about later on in this discussion. Another type of document parties should be striving to obtain through discovery are educational records. One of the major goals we have in all juvenile cases is to ensure the children involved in the cases are obtaining proper education. For delinquency and CHINs, there is a provision under FERPA which indicates disclosures are permitted to state and local officials or authorities to whom the information is specifically allowed to be disclosed pursuant to our state statute. The disclosure must concern the juvenile justice system and its ability to effectively serve the student whose records are disclosed prior to adjudication. These authorities to whom the records are disclosed must certify in writing to the district that the information will not be disclosed to other parties except for as provided by state law, unless they have written consent of the parents. Again, this is an area where protective orders may be beneficial in securing these documents outside of the state statutes for confidentiality, which will also be discussed in just a few minutes. For abuse and neglect cases, FERPA also prevents disclosures under judicial order or lawfully issued subpoenas. Upon judicial order, districts must make reasonable efforts to notify the parent or eligible student of the order or subpoena in advance of disclosures, so they might seek protective action. Once an order is produced, a district will comply in a timely manner. However, it is specifically noted that timely is not defined under FERPA. The last type of document, although not protected by legislation, but necessary to obtain through the discovery process, and that should be acquired by DFS, the prosecutor, or the GAL prior to adjudication, relate to ICWA. These documents should be obtained as soon as possible, and we should be trying to obtain any documents that may lead to information regarding a child possible in the inheritance. ICWA procedures needs to be followed from the beginning of the case onward. One repercussion of not following ICWA with a child that falls under that provision or act is all proceedings may be void once brought to the court's attention. This means the case goes back to adjudication phase, and nothing that has been done has legal or binding effect. This can even occur, this voiding of the proceedings can even occur after a finalized adoption. One great way of making this record is to produce an interrogatory to each of the parents requiring them to list any known family connection with any tribe. By then putting this response on the record, the state and GAL ensure that there is not an argument later to void the proceedings under ICWA. This is an active effort to ensure ICWA does not apply in a specific case. Along with the information just discussed, Rule 3 also requires the state be required to provide records created by VFS. However, VFS is permitted to contest the discovery request. Your best option is to approach them and ask for the documents first, but Ms. Wendy Ross will speak about that in a few minutes. That about summarizes the state's obligation, other than the requirement for ongoing discovery. Throughout the case, the state and all other parties must supplement discovery to all the other parties as it becomes known. A subsequent request for discovery is not necessary as a requirement for this to be in effect. The parties must provide all discovery continuously throughout the case. Although all the above discussed information is required without demand for discovery, to make a record, it is beneficial to always submit a demand for discovery. This prompts the state's attorney to provide proper discovery to the proper parties. To assist in this, in the materials provided for today's presentation, you will find a template demand for discovery to provide to the state's attorney in all juvenile cases. I would also urge all guardian ad litem and parents' attorneys to resubmit this request for discovery if you are not receiving the ongoing discovery. This includes the narrative, UAs, and the like that should be occurring on a regular basis. This may sound as if it is a large burden on the state. However, the delivery method of discovery allowed for under Rule 3 allows for communication to the other parties that discovery is available for review. I have provided in the materials a sample and appropriate letter that comports to Rule 3 method of discovery. However, please remember to send the subsequent communication as discovery becomes available throughout this case. This method of discovery does not provide for any other discovery requests made through the standard rules of civil procedure, such as interrogatories or requests for production. Just quickly, I will remind you that juvenile cases are civil cases and do fall under the civil rules of procedure. Wendy's going to talk to you in a few minutes about civil procedure and how it applies to juvenile cases. However, it is important to realize that those can also be provided for in the underlying juvenile case. However, these responses must be provided to the requesting party through traditional means of disbursement, including mail of copies of all documents requested. Now that we've talked about how discovery can be used to ensure respondents and GALs are receiving the information needed from the state, let's talk about how the state and GAL can use Rule 3 to get the necessary information from the respondent, whether that respondent be a parent in an abuse and neglect case or a child in a CHIN or delinquency proceeding. The first step to getting discovery from the respondent is a demand for discovery. Unlike the requirement for the state to automatically provide discovery, the respondent only must provide discovery upon specific request. To that end, you will find in your materials a template for the request for discovery for the respondent. This request requires the respondent to produce the name and contact information of each witness, expert reports, and information for alibi witness. At this time, I will again remind you of Rule 4, which also requires that not later than 5 business days prior to the hearing, where any report is to be offered for consideration, the party offering the report shall file the report with the court and provide a copy of the report to be offered to all parties. Outside of that request, the respondent might be required to partake in any number of actions to aid in discovery. This includes appearing for a lineup, speaking for identification, being fingerprinted, posing for photographs, trying on articles of clothing, permitting the taking of specimens of materials under his fingernails, permitting the taking of his body samples of blood, hair, or other materials involving no unreasonable intrusion upon his person, and otherwise submitting to reasonable physical inspection of his body or a mental health examination. These actions can be helpful in the development of a case after the case is charged. However, it is important to remember, in juvenile cases, discovery is ongoing, and so the request may be made and granted at any point during the proceedings. For example, a hair follicle test may be used in later months of a case to help determine a permanency plan and aid the state or GAL in proving the necessity for a change in permanency. A mental health evaluation may be requested and used for similar purposes. There is also formal discovery that can be done on the respondent, as stated previously. I believe this often gets missed, as we live in a hybrid world in juvenile law. The parents or the respondents are often treated in a criminal nature when we are in a civil case. So please remember that you can partake in all civil discovery demands to the respondent as well. So those are the requirements of what we need to do under Rule 3 and some of the things we can do with Rule 3. But then the question becomes, what are the consequences for noncompliance? There are 6 consequences laid out in Rule 3 that are: order such a party to permit discovery of the matters not previously disclosed, strike the testimony to which the undisclosed matters relate, grant a reasonable continuance, prohibit the party from introducing in evidence the matter not disclosed, grant a mistrial, or any other such repercussion the court finds appropriate. This really indicates that the court may do anything to us if we do not follow these rules, and anything can be asked for as a sanction to not following these rules. So is it important for us to refresh ourselves on the rules and apply them to the extent possible. The last thing I'm going to talk about is the confidentiality of documents that are produced. The juvenile court process is confidential by statute. Specifically, all records concerning reports and investigations of child abuse or neglect are confidential except for as provided for Wyoming Statute 143201 through 143215. Any person who willfully violates this subsection is guilty of a misdemeanor, and upon conviction shall be fined not more than $500 or imprisoned in the county jail for not more than 6 months, or both. Due to the confidential nature of the juvenile court cases, the public is generally excluded. Foster parents may be the exception to this rule, unless excluding them is in the best interest of the child or necessary to protect privacy. In special instances, the court may also include certain individuals to attend hearings. For example, wraparound providers may be able to attend to provide testimony or on a specific issue, or if the wrap provider was appointed to the multidisciplinary team. This also includes other members of the multidisciplinary team, including family members and treatment providers. This is important for parents' attorneys to recognize that their clients are not exempt from the confidentiality of these documents. If they choose to provide it to any member of the public, they are in violation of these statutes and may be charged with a misdemeanor for providing that those documents to any member of the public. I would urge all parents attorneys to have a conversation at the beginning of every case to ensure your clients understand the confidential nature of the proceeding so we don't end up with further litigation on the matter. Really, juvenile discovery comes down to the rules, and they're there, and we just need to follow them and take advantage of them. The more informed all members of the team are, the better we can all work together in an effort to improve the lives of our clients. I urge you to consider what you are requesting, if you are doing your part in making the record whole, and getting the most information you can to adequately support your position and your client. Remember, discovery is ongoing, and all members of the team should remain updated at all times. And please maintain confidentiality in the process. Now, Wendy will talk to you a little bit more about termination and the civil rules of procedure relating to termination cases. Thank you.
Thank you, Hope. My name is Wendy Ross, and I am a Senior Assistant Attorney General with the Wyoming Attorney General's Office. I represent the Department of Family Services across the state, doing many things, but one thing that we do a lot of are representing the department in termination of parental rights cases. So I'd want to talk a little bit about discovery in those cases and then the ability to gain access to the department's records in some other context. So starting with termination of parental rights cases, I wanted to point out that those cases are separate civil cases, so they are separate from a juvenile abuse or neglect action or any other type of juvenile court action, whether that is a delinquency case or a child in need of supervision case. And so because they are separate civil cases, the Wyoming Rules of Civil Procedure apply to those cases, including all of the discovery tools that are included in the Wyoming Rules of Civil Procedure. But they are, those discovery rules are different than the discovery rules lined out in the Rules of Procedure for Juvenile Courts that Hope was just talking about. So in a termination of parental rights case, you would not do a discovery demand. It would need to be an appropriate request under the Rules of Civil Procedure. So kind of going through the different discovery rules that are applicable to these cases, I wanted to start with Rule 26. Rule 26 has a lot of things in it, but one of the things in Rule 26 are initial disclosures, and Rule 26 specifically exempts Title 14 actions from those initial disclosure requirements. So while it is a civil case like any other type of civil litigation, there are some special quirks in the rules that don't apply to these cases. So because termination of parental rights actions are brought under Title 14, there are no initial disclosure requirements for any party in a termination of parental rights case as opposed to another type of civil litigation. But all of the rest of the discovery tools are available in these cases. So starting with interrogatories, the Wyoming Rules of Civil Procedure limit in a request for interrogatories to 25 questions, including discrete subparts. So if the department receives a request from a parent attorney or a guardian ad litem with more than 25 questions, the department is likely going to object to answering any question above that limit. Certainly, any party in these cases is permitted to ask leave of court to ask more questions, but 25 is the limit without further permission from the court. Interrogatories must be answered within 30 days They have to be answered by the party to whom they are directed, and they have to be answered in writing and under oath. That's a pretty important requirement. Obviously, discovery is a tool that can be used to gain more information to prosecute your case or to defend your case. But at the same time, discovery can be used as an impeachment tool in a later trial of the termination of parental rights case. So to be able to do that, we need to have the questions answered under oath by the person answering them. And that that obviously goes both ways. So when the department receives a discovery request, in these cases, those interrogatories are going to be answered by a caseworker from the Department of Family Services as the department's client representative, like you would have the parent answer in the instance of the parent receiving the discovery request. Parties can object to answering interrogatories. The objections have to be made timely, so they have to be made within those 30 days that you have to answer. And if you don't make the objection within that time, then your objection is waived under the rules. The objection must also be stated specifically. So you have to give your specific grounds for your objection when you're making it. The objections, any objections made must be signed by the attorney that is making the objection. Alternatively, if the party is unrepresented, then the pro se party would be signing the objection, much like they would sign the answers or a request. But the objections themselves must be signed. So another big tool that we have in the discovery context for termination of parental rights cases is under Rule 34, and that's request for production of documents. Request for production of documents is the appropriate tool to request production of the department's file in a termination of parental rights case. Termination of parental rights cases, I should have said this earlier when I was talking generally about the fact that they're civil cases, they are not confidential under statute. Juvenile cases are, civil termination of parental rights cases are not. But some of the same confidentiality requirements as far as the records go do apply. But obviously, if the department is going to be relying on the information in their file to prosecute the termination case, then the department is going to have to provide that information to the parents and the guardian ad litem upon an appropriate request so that they have fair access to that material to be able to defend the case. So if the parent is wanting to look at the department's file in a termination of parental rights case, the way to do that is to submit a request for production of documents requesting the department's file. And so in response to an appropriate request, the department will produce the file. There will likely be a redaction of information in those files, birth dates, social security numbers, other third-party information, home studies, criminal history information of a third party, mental health and substance abuse counseling information of a parent that is involved in the case but that is not the parent asking for the discovery may also be redacted and removed from production in those instances. Additionally, the department certainly keeps records in their files from school, medical records, police reports, things like that. So the department will produce records in its possession that are responsive to a request, but The department may object to producing documents that the department does not have in its possession if those documents are easily available to the respondent parent, such as the respondent parent's medical records, counseling records, things like that, that the department may have some of but cannot access, whereas the parent can go access those records themselves. Under Rule 34, there is no limit to how many requests for production of documents that a party can make in a civil case, whereas we saw there was a limit to interrogatory. So no limit there. They have to be answered again in writing within 30 days, and the responses must be signed by the attorney of record on the case, or if the party is unrepresented, the party. You will see in responses to interrogatories and responses to requests for admissions in Rule 33 and then in Rule 36, there's specific information in those rules about who can sign those responses. But in Rule 34, there isn't a specific to that rule who can sign it. So you find that information in Rule 26G1 that talks about generally responding to discovery requests in civil cases. So then our next tool that we have available to us in termination of parental rights cases is a request for admissions. Requests for admissions can be helpful for a variety of reasons. It can you can use those to help limit your issues for trial or to more narrow your issues for trial. Again, as with the request for production of documents, there's no limit on how many a party can ask. Requests for admissions must be answered in writing within 30 days. There are consequences for failing to timely respond to requests for admissions. If the requests for admissions are not responded to within 30 days, they are automatically deemed admitted without anybody having to file a motion or anything like that. They are just deemed admitted at that point in time. And it's up to the party who failed to respond to those timely to request relief from the court as far as the admissions that then exist in the record. With requests for admissions, Rule 36 talks about who can sign the responses to those. They must be signed, and they can be signed by either the attorney of record or the party that the requests are directed to. You can also use requests for admissions to ask somebody to admit that a document is genuine. Again, this can be used to narrow issues for trial, including admissibility of documents. But if you're going to use a request for admission to ask someone to admit the genuineness of a document, you have to provide a copy of the document that you're asking the person to admit the authenticity of. So another discovery tool available in termination of parental rights cases that we see used sometimes, but not as often as the written tools that we've discussed are depositions. Generally, leave of court is not required to conduct depositions in these cases, with a couple of caveats. As in all civil cases, if you're requesting more than 10 depositions, you must get leave of court to do any depositions that are over that limit of 10. And then the other caveat is that in a case where the parent has received court-appointed counsel because they're indigent and the department is then responsible for paying reasonable costs of litigation at that point, the department may have a specific objection based on the fact of and circumstances of the case at that time, that the cost of that deposition is not reasonable. And the department has, in certain instances, filed objections with the court to doing depositions that the department believes are an unreasonable cost. So just know that that is out there. And certainly if you're wanting to do depositions in a termination of parental rights case, certainly talk with the department's attorney, whether that is somebody through our office or the local prosecutor's office is doing it, so that you can try to resolve those issues without court intervention. Rule 37 talks about sanctions available where we have discovery violations. This rule is available in these actions as a civil case. Rule 37 requires a good faith attempt to procure discovery responses before asking for the court to intervene on your behalf. Whether you've received no discovery responses or whether the discovery responses that you have received are deficient, you have to confer with the opposing counsel or the opposing party if they are unrepresented before filing a motion to compel production of those responses with the court. The court is then authorized to order sanctions in certain instances. The court can order sanctions for failing to comply with discovery requests, and then the court can also order sanctions for parties who violate a court order regarding discovery. And in any civil case, but also in these termination of parental rights cases, if a party violates a court order regarding discovery, then the court can hold somebody in contempt of court, and they can also go so far as to enter default against a parent in these cases for failing to comply with a court's order to produce discovery. And I actually recently had a termination of parental rights jury trial in Laramie County at the end of January, and the parent in that case did not comply with the court's order to produce discovery and had many refusals to provide information, and the court held her in contempt and allowed that information to be conveyed to the jury in that case of the mom's failure to comply with the court's orders on discovery. So just know that that's out there as far as compliance with discovery. Certainly those rules can be used against the department as well if the department is failing to comply with discovery requests or orders to produce discovery. But again, you have to confer with opposing counsel before asking for court intervention in those instances. The other thing that I wanted to talk about, I think Hope mentioned a little bit of, was protective orders. Protective orders can be found in Rule 26C, and a party can ask the court for a protective order to protect a party from annoyance, embarrassment, oppression, or undue burden or expense in responding to discovery. So if you're representing a parent in a termination of parental rights case and you think that there is a basis to not respond to discovery on one of those grounds, you can certainly ask the court for a protective order to prevent your client from responding to discovery, but you need to do that before the time for responding to discovery expires. And again, if this is something that you are interested in doing, You must include a certification in your motion that you have, in good faith, conferred or attempted to confer with other affected parties in that case in an effort to resolve the dispute without court action. But we also see protective orders used in the context of keeping information confidential in these cases or in instances where the department is ordered to produce records in other cases so that the confidential information isn't further disseminated. As in the juvenile cases, you also have a duty to supplement your discovery responses in termination of parental rights cases. You have an ongoing duty to do that in a timely manner. And if you fail to properly supplement your discovery responses, sanctions may be imposed. What that usually means for the department as far as the duty to supplement, these cases obviously have an ongoing juvenile neglect case or a juvenile delinquency or a CHINS case. And so there's continuing to be additions to the department's case file in those matters. And so the department's attorneys in that case should be providing regular updates to parties as far as what new things have been added to the department's file if there has been a previous request for the department's file in that matter. That would be the department's obligation to continue to update that discovery response. I also wanted to talk a little bit about the pretrial disclosures required in Rule 26 in these cases. Typically, this is going to be handled by the court in a scheduling order after conducting a scheduling conference and talking with parties about deadlines for pretrial disclosures, including expert disclosures. But in the event that your scheduling order does not have a stated deadline for producing witness and exhibit disclosures or expert disclosures, the rules do contain some built-in provisions if the court doesn't otherwise order it. So with regard to lay witnesses and exhibits, parties are required to disclose anticipated witnesses and exhibits within 30 days at least 30 days before the trial. And for witnesses, that includes contact information. And then as far as expert disclosures go, again, if the court doesn't cover this in the scheduling order, then parties must disclose their anticipated expert witness testimony at least 90 days before the trial and then follow those disclosure rules in Rule 26. But the department often in these cases is not using a retained expert. The department is most often using non-retained experts, meaning treating providers, counselors, medical professionals, maybe a chemical analysis person from the state lab. And so the department is most often using those non-retained experts, and the disclosure requirements for those persons are different than for using a retained expert. There doesn't need to be a report produced like you would for a retained expert. But my best advice is pay close attention to the scheduling order with regard to what the court is expecting you to disclose, because the language in those orders is going to be different from court to court. So pay close attention to that as far as what you're required to disclose. And then the language of Rule 26A2 with regard to those experts. So I will try to leave a little bit of time for questions. I just have a little bit left to talk about with regard to discovery of DFS records in other contexts. Certainly, there are there are other instances where you may want access to DFS records or testimony from a DFS caseworker in a civil case or a criminal case that is not specifically related to the instance where the department may keep records. The department keeps a lot of different kinds of records, and each of those different categories of records has their own confidentiality provisions. And I have those different statutes or regulations listed on the slide if you go download those materials from the CJP website. But we keep records with regard to child protection, adult protection, children and youth supervision, delinquency, juvenile probation, welfare benefits, and then child support is another area that I don't think we typically think of as those are Department of Family Services records, but they are, and that confidentiality provision is governed by federal regulations. So each of those different statutes and regulations have different requirements for how you gain access to the records. Most often the department is receiving requests for information about child protection records. So that's where I focus most of my information, but certainly there are other records that may be relevant, delinquency records, adult protection. So look at those different confidentiality provisions to figure out what you need to do to gain access to those records. For criminal cases, if you're looking for testimony from a Department of Family Services caseworker, the department may not be filing a motion to quash, but typically the department caseworker will raise the confidentiality of the information in the proceeding when asked about it, and then the judge may or may not order the caseworker to provide that information on the stand. If you're looking for that information to be provided in a criminal case, certainly communicate with the Department of Family Services attorneys through our office, and we can at least give you an idea of what our plan is to do in that case and to better serve you. It may be better to have the court make that finding about whether or not the information should be released in the proceeding before the proceeding if you're looking at having somebody testify in a jury trial rather than having that information come out on the stand, you know, as far as whether or not the caseworker is going to answer your questions at that point in time. And so the analysis for the department on whether or not that the information is okay to be testified about is going to depend on what type of information you are seeking to have produced in those cases. So requests for documents are analyzed a little bit differently. There is a recent Wyoming Supreme Court case. It's from 2017, and it is the state of Wyoming versus Hathaway. And in that case, the Supreme Court talked about how to get access to records in these criminal cases. And there's some pretty stringent requirements. To even get an in-camera review by the court, the defendant must show that the information that they are seeking out of those files is specific, and that the information is constitutionally material, and the case talks about what those different things mean. So again, if you're looking to get some CPS records in a criminal case as part of your defense, there's a bit of a high burden to get those records produced. In civil cases, again, with regard to Child Protective Services records, there is a requirement in the statute the court has to find good cause to release that information if the proceeding is not directly related to an abuse or neglect proceeding. So again, you're going to need a court order finding good cause to release that information, whether it be documents or testimony about the documents. There are other ways that people can request information from DFS without a subpoena. There are forms that a parent can fill out if they're wanting access to DFS, their own DFS records, or if any other person is wanting access to DFS records. They can fill out an SS-31, which is a social services form, or an APS-31, which relates to adult protection, through the local field office, and the district manager reviews those requests and either grants access or does not. With those requests, you have to meet you have to be a person that is entitled to access those records under statute, and you have to articulate a specific purpose that is consistent with the different statutes to be able to gain access to that information. And again, the manager is who decides whether or not to grant that request. So my final tip is, if you are wanting DFS records for use in a civil or criminal case, the AG's office is more than willing to help evaluate your request, including accepting service of a subpoena. So just get in touch with us beforehand, and we can maybe help make the process a little smoother, or at least we can tell you whether or not we would file a motion to quash in that situation and help navigate that process. So I will turn it over to Whitney to, if there are any questions, or she can close us out. Thank you.
Thank you, Wendy and Hope. I really appreciate it. We have a few people on the phone, so I'm going to go ahead and open up the phone lines and see if we have any questions. If you're on the phone and you have a question, you should be able to talk now. And if we don't have any questions, I will just thank you both for an excellent Blog Talk and all your time in preparing and giving the presentation today.
Thank you, Whitney.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.